This is Srinivas Rao, the host of the Vistage podcast series, and today I'm speaking with Peter Sims. Peter is an award-winning author and entrepreneur. His latest book is Little Bets, How Breakthrough Ideas Emerge from Small Discoveries, which grew out of a collaboration with the faculty at Stanford's D School, a hub of creative thinking and doing, and his previous work in venture capital with Summit Partners, including as part of the team established at Summit's European office in London. He's also the co-author with Bill George of the bestseller True North, Discover Your Authentic Leadership, is a member of GE's Innovation Advisory Panel, and is a co-founder and director of Fuse Corps, a social venture that places entrepreneurial leaders on year-long grassroots projects with mayors and governors to tackle some of America's most pressing problems. Thanks for taking the time to join us today, Peter.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
So let's start with a basic question just to sort of set the tone of our conversation. What exactly is a little bet?
Yeah, so a little bet is just a small, affordable action that anyone can take to discover new ideas. So the analogy I like to use is that when you see a comedian like Chris Rock on HBO, he's flawless, but to get there, he spent months in small clubs making literally thousands of little bets on ideas, and he can't predict which ones are going to work or which won't until he goes into these clubs and tries them and has to go through this process of making little bets in order to discover what's going to be a great joke and a great act.
Mm-hmm. So you've profiled several successful individuals and companies, people like Chris Rock throughout the book. Could you talk a little bit about how some of these people leverage making little bets to not only perform at the level they do, but also produce at the level they do on a consistent basis?
Sure. Well, a couple of the other examples are the filmmakers at Pixar. So on a very regular basis, Pixar makes little bets to develop out and build their stories and movies and characters within those movies. So they'll use between 50,000 and 60,000 storyboards for every Pixar film. They will begin the process by knowing vaguely where they want to go. They'll have a rough idea of the story, but really won't have any sense for the plot twists and turns or even the characters fleshed out. And it's only by literally going into a conference room and pinning up these storyboards, these 5x8 note cards with sketches drawn on them and with some rough dialogue underneath the storyboards, that they're able to flesh out what's working and what's not. And their goal is really to just find what the problems are, solve the problems as they go. So as Ed Catmull, the co-founder of Pixar, says, their creative process is going from suck to non-suck. Now, the point behind all that is that when you're doing something new, when you're in uncertainty and you don't know what the answers are going to be, you need to do things to discover what to do rather than try to spend all your time analyzing and perfecting ideas in a plan or in an Excel spreadsheet. And so as Jeff Bezos will say, you can't predict how people are going to respond to a new idea in an Excel spreadsheet. You literally have to go out and make these small bets.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about the psychology of taking risks a little bit, because I think there is a bit of that involved in making little bets, and in many ways, little bets is about taking risks. So let me ask you this. I mean, what is it that you think makes people so risk-averse in general, and what can they do to get past that?
Well, I think from a very early age, we're taught to have perfect answers. That's a big reason why people don't like to do anything that's not perfect. We're afraid of making errors because we're penalized for making errors so often in our educational system. And so that perfectionism runs very deep in not only the U.S., but in other cultures. And what can actually help make a difference, according to Dr. Carol Dweck, who's the leading researcher on how people respond to failures and setbacks, is to literally go out and be comfortable doing things that aren't perfect, what the novelist Anne Lamott might call shitty first drafts, where you're beginning something new, just try something. Mm-hmm. Doesn't matter how imperfect. Use that as a whether it's a prototype or a draft or just a piece of cardboard that you rumple up into an initial idea, as the folks at P&G now do with their new ideas, and just bounce it off of an early adopter. Bounce it off of somebody who can give you some feedback quickly to see if you're going down the right path, and just to be able to really quickly test your assumptions with these crummy first drafts.
Mm-hmm. And, one of the things that you referenced actually in regards to Carol Dweck's research, which I really enjoyed, was the idea of the fixed mindset, growth mindset, or the changed growth mindset, one of those two things. Can you talk about that a little bit and expand on that?
Yeah, sure. So Dweck has been studying how people respond to failure and setbacks for a couple decades, and she's really began by looking at how young kids respond to not doing well on something, say an exam where they got a C or a D. And she found that some of the kids would get that grade, that low grade, and they'd want to give up and not take that same exam again, thinking that they were not smart. Those are kids she described as having the fixed mindset. They believe their intelligence and their abilities are fixed. They're set in stone. So no matter how much effort they exert, they're never going to get any better. Now, on the other hand, there were some students who would take an exam and they'd say, they wouldn't do well, and they'd say, well, give me it again tomorrow. I'll study harder and I'll do better. She said that those were the types of kids who tended to have more of a growth mindset. And when it comes to kids, she found that the big difference between kids who had a growth mindset and the kids that had a fixed mindset was they were praised for different things. So kids with a growth mindset were praised by their parents or their teachers for how much effort they put into their pursuits, whereas kids with a fixed mindset were praised primarily for the result, the grade or the attainment, the athletic attainment that they had arrived at. And so what Dweck has said is that anybody can develop a growth mindset later in life if they're willing to put themselves out there and try things, as I mentioned in the last question, such as a prototype or a crummy first draft, and see how through that process of being imperfect they can get closer and closer to perfection, just as a comedian might through spending 6 months in small clubs.
Mm-hmm. I mean, one of the themes I noticed throughout the book, no matter who you were looking at and who you profiled, was that what we see as the final product is very different from where they start. And it seems like this, we confuse what we actually see as the final product with what actually went into the process. And it seems like Little Bets is all about really just refining that process and going through multiple iterations of whatever it is you're working on.
And there are ways you can be really strategic about the discovery process. So Little Bets is really about discovery, and the core premise is that when you're doing something new, you use these small bets as a discovery tool. But there's lots of other things that you can do to get better and more strategic at this. So just paying attention to what the early adopters are saying is one example of that. So for example, in my case, in deciding to write a book, I put together a crummy first draft before getting to even the proposal. And that draft was entitled Emergent Innovation. It was a terrible title. But the subtitle was how little bets turn into big wins. And when I bounced this draft off of book agents and fellow authors, friends of mine, they all responded by saying they really liked that term, little bets, that it was core to what I was getting at. And so when I moved that into the title, all of a sudden everybody wanted to work on it. So it's this way of thinking and working that's influenced by design thinking and by, you know, how all these different types of creative people work, whether it's Frank Gehry or people who were, you know, generals leading counterinsurgency missions in the Middle East. It was amazing to me how similar they think. They think in terms of problems first and then solutions. They think in terms of using constraints. They think in terms of using these, little special pilots with early adopters where they can test their ideas before scaling up. And so we never get taught how to think like this in school, but it's how anyone can be more innovative and creative.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I've found that in my own experience with anything entrepreneurial I've done. And I think the other thing that is sort of nice about this little bets approach things, it allows you to take risks. And also, I think I remember you saying this in the book, where you don't end up spending all your time working on something that nobody actually wants or nobody even will buy. And I think we've seen this process with numerous startups and other businesses as they sort of go through pivots and as their original business models change.
Yeah. You know, I used to be in venture capital, as you mentioned at the outset, and I never saw a business end up where it started, if that makes any sense. I mean, Starbucks is a great example. Starbucks, envisioned by Howard Schultz to recreate the Italian coffee experience that he had so loved in Milan. And when you look at Schultz's process of creating Starbucks, the first store in Seattle had nonstop opera music playing. Menus are written in Italian, and the baristas were wearing bow ties, much like the Italian coffee experience. But there weren't even any chairs, you know. And so, as Schultz says, and make a lot of mistakes to discover what was going to work and what wasn't. And that's just this mentality that entrepreneurs get. They think in terms of what they can afford to lose when they're trying something new, rather than what they can expect to gain. They don't try to plan out in advance their entire end result business because they know that it's going to have to evolve as they learn more by getting out in the world.
Mm-hmm. Well, you may have just answered this question, but I found a quote that I thought was really interesting in one of the articles you wrote where you said entrepreneurs think of learning the way most people think of failure. Can you expand on what you mean by this?
Yeah, so that line was really one that was motivated by seeing entrepreneurs in the U.S. and Europe try things all the time that ended up failing in our, you know, in our traditional versions of success and failure. They didn't get anywhere with the idea at first, but then they were able to use that learning to evolve it into something that became much more interesting in the case of the great entrepreneurs. So Howard Schultz didn't sell non-fat lattes when he first started the Starbucks in Seattle, but you know, he found that through some experimentation that that's what an unbelievable number of people wanted, despite it being, you know, at odds with the Italian coffee experience. They started doing it, and now I think non-fat lattes are something like 50% of the business. But you see all these examples of companies, especially, you know, in Silicon Valley, you can just go down the list of companies that started off as one idea and evolved into another. You know, Google began as a library search project at Stanford to prioritize library searches, and PayPal began as a site that it was a tool that was doing, you know, exchanges for something very menial in Blackberries before they were able to log on to the payment processing. And you know, you see this with YouTube, which began as a dating website. So examples are numerous, and the point is that you really have to figure out what problems you are solving before you scale up into something that's going to be breakthrough. And my argument is use the little bets, the affordable risks, to figure out what the right problems and the needs are and the opportunities are. And then once you found that, then bet big.
Mm-hmm. So if you were talking to a, you know, Vistage business owner or entrepreneur and you wanted to get them just sort of started in this process or to get them comfortable, where would you suggest they start incorporating this into their own business efforts?
Well, that's literally why I picked the title of Little Bets, is to give somebody, anybody, a vehicle to do something that's affordable and achievable tomorrow or today. What can you do with $5,000 or $10,000 or $20,000, whatever you see as an affordable bet, in order to see if you can't discover something that you wouldn't have been able to predict going into it? So the way Jeff Bezos thinks about this is if he and his senior team think that they have an opportunity in a new market that they think is interesting, they use the rule of thumb that, hey, if we can see this business getting to, say, $10 million, let's make a little bet and let's put some of our best people on it and see where it can go. And so it's for him, that's an affordable bet. For others, it'll be, you know, what can I do to reshape a meeting starting today using a small bet? It's not going to cause any downside risk for the most part if it doesn't work. It's going to be affordable risk. And who knows what might open up. And if you get into that mentality of thinking that way when you're doing something new, I think that's really the key to discovery and innovation.
Mm-hmm. Well, Peter, thanks so much for taking the time to join us and share some of your insights with the Vistage listeners. And until next time, good luck with your business.